Hey, listeners, did you know that Consider Before Consuming is a podcast by Fight the New Drug? Fight the New Drug is a non-religious, non-legislative, 501c3 nonprofit that exists to provide individuals the opportunity to make an informed decision regarding pornography by raising awareness on the harmful effects using only science, facts, and personal accounts. Fight the New Drug is research-based, education-focused, sex-positive, and anti-shame. To learn more about Fight the New Drug and to see the additional free resources that we offer, like our three-part documentary series and our interactive conversation guide, visit ftnd.org. That's ftnd.org.
My name is Garrett Johnson, and you're listening to Consider Before Consuming, a podcast by Fight the New Drug. We want these conversations to be educational, uplifting, and hopeful. As we sit down with experts, influencers, activists, and people with personal accounts, we cover a wide variety of topics that may be triggering to some. You can refer to the episode notes for a specific trigger warning. Listener discretion is advised. Today's episode is with Nicholas Kristof. He's an American journalist, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, and columnist at the New York Times since 2001. His opinion piece, published in December 2020, titled The Children of Pornhub Rattled the World, when it gave visibility to the victims of image-based sexual abuse and child sexual abuse materials that are shared on porn sites and social media platforms. We're grateful that he took time out of his busy schedule to speak with us and give our listeners more insight into this topic. In the limited amount of time that we were able to meet, we did our best to go through as many questions as we could, discussing questions we knew our listeners would have. With that being said, let's jump into the conversation. We hope you enjoy this episode of Consider Before Consuming.
Hello.
Hi, let me just turn my volume up. Hi, how are you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
Good, really good. Good to meet you.
Yeah, good to meet you.
Okay, how does that sound?
Sounds good on my end. Sounds really good.
Good, good.
You just got the little lapel mic there. Looks yep. Like you're a professional. Looks like you've done this before.
A little bit.
Yeah, I can imagine. Where are you geographically?
New York, just outside New York, but heading back to Oregon probably in the next week or so, where I'm from.
Yeah. I lived a year in Oregon.
Oh, where'd you live?
In Portland.
Okay.
Yeah, I was really young, so my family moved there. I don't remember it much, but we go on a road trip almost every other year, and we include the Oregon coast in that road trip.
Isn't that coast just beautiful?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really is. You were born and raised there, right?
Yep.
Yeah. How much time do you spend in New York versus Oregon?
I mean, traditionally, it's been more time in New York, but the last few years, because of the most recent book we did and because my mom is getting older and she's there. So it's getting closer to, to half-half or, 40% here, 40% there, and another 20% somewhere else.
Right. Well, speaking of which, because one of the things that I was amazed by as I learned more about you was all of the different places that you have lived. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you've lived on four continents and you've traveled to over 150 countries. Is that right?
That's right.
Wow. So is that part of your journalism?
My dad was a World War II refugee. And so, he was very international. He spoke many languages. And so I inherited that wanderlust, you might say, but then it also came about just as a reporter. I was based abroad for the New York Times for 15, 16 years. And I came to believe that it's really important not just to talk to a few experts in Washington, but to actually go out and talk to local people and get out of the Capitol. And it's very much a kind of reporting I like to do.
Right. And you're the winner of two Pulitzer Prizes.
That's correct.
And do you think that travel and that investigative spirit that you have, do you think that helped in winning those?
I suppose so. I mean, one of them was when I was based in China. And so that was, you know, clearly a function of speaking Chinese, getting out, talking to people. And the other was mostly for Darfur. And there again, it was a matter of going to a really remote place and trying to piece together a genocide that had been just, you know, astonishingly brutal, but because it wasn't a very remote place, wasn't getting attention.
Yeah. Well, we are, we're grateful to have you. You're an accomplished person. You've accomplished so much in your life. Just to name a few, you studied law at Harvard.
No, at Oxford.
At Oxford. Okay.
Yeah.
And you've, like I mentioned, traveled, you've lived on four continents. You've been a columnist for the New York Times since 2001. What's something that you're proud of that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, I mean, I have raised, I think, three amazing kids, and, you know, we've traveled a lot together. They've done some really good things. And I think I've helped in my journalism career put some issues on the map that maybe wouldn't have got attention otherwise, the Darfur genocide, for one. I think there are some, you know, women's health issues like obstetric fistula that I think got more attention. Human trafficking, I think I got a little more attention to. So, I mean, that's all, you know, that's all encouraging.
Right. Well, we admire your work, and the reason why you're with us today is the name of our podcast is Consider Before Consuming, and we put forth information that people should consider before consuming pornography. And so I want to start off, you kind of already mentioned the awareness that you've brought to sex trafficking, but I wanted to better understand how you first became aware of or interested in image-based abuse on porn sites.
So it... I mean, it really flowed out of my work on sex trafficking. And, you know, that went back to one trip that I made in, it was 1996 or 1997, I forget. And I was based in Tokyo. I made a trip to the Philippines and Cambodia to look at trafficking of children. And particularly in Cambodia, I just could not believe what I was seeing, Garrett. I mean, there were, I went to a place where young girls were being auctioned off for their virginity. I went to a brothel where there was a 15-year-old girl who'd been, and a 14-year-old girl who'd been kidnapped and were imprisoned in that brothel. And they were going to be there until they died of AIDS. And I just could not believe this was happening. It was like slavery. And so then I began reporting about that from other places, including in the U.S., and I was very distressed to see to the degree to which this was a problem in the U.S. as well. Not of the magnitude that it was in some Asian countries, but I thought we didn't have the moral right to tell other countries to clean up their act unless we made greater effort to do so at home. And so then I had written occasionally about child sexual abuse imagery in this country. And I thought there was this misperception. I mean, I think a lot of Americans think that this involves, some 15-year-old girl who pulls off her shirt or something. And in fact, you know, as you know, it's often about, you know, prepubescent kids who are being raped in every which way and with impunity. So then last summer, I sort of been following the Pornhub. I was aware of it, but I didn't really know what to think of it. And then asked some people, then went online, and some of the first images that I saw were of unconscious women who were being stripped and raped. And the rapists, to prove that they were unconscious, were touching their eyeballs to show that these women were drugged out, drunk, I don't know what it was. You look at this unconscious woman being raped in a company, a major internet company is monetizing that. And you think about what that does to those women when they find out that this rape. I mean, they're not only brutalized for half an hour or somewhere, they're brutalized for the rest of their lives for all to see. And so for me, at least, it's, you know, it's one thing to have this debate at 30,000 feet about rights and how and regulation. And then when you actually see those images, that was, you know, really pretty horrifying. And that shook me up. And that's when I decided I want to write about this.
And since your piece on Pornhub, that happened in December of 2020, so really recently. Can you talk to some of the changes that have been made, that Pornhub has made since December of 2020?
Yeah. I mean, I should clarify that it wasn't that Pornhub read my piece and said, oh boy, Nick, you really wrote it very effectively. We're convinced. Well, you know, basically what happened was the credit card companies then said, okay, we're going to investigate. And then very promptly they said, okay, there's illegal content on Pornhub and we will therefore not process credit card payments for the company, at least for in terms of direct services. I think that they will still accept credit card payments for ads, but that shook up Pornhub in a way that my writing did not. And so as a result, Pornhub stopped the downloading of videos, and most important, they took off all the unverified images on their website, which is about 10 million images, so about 2/3 of their images and videos. And so that was a huge transformation. I got a note from one young woman who'd had a naked video of herself on Pornhub for the last year. She'd been unable to get it down. And she said that, and it was taken down now. And she said, you know, I can breathe again. That's very cool.
Yeah, that's neat. Speaking to those changes that Pornhub has made since December of 2020, are you proud of the changes that have been made?
Yeah, I'd say I am. I mean, I think that in journalism, so I'm a columnist and, you know, so I'm in the opinion business, but I actually think that our impact is less in terms of changing people's minds on things that they've thought about. So if I write about Donald Trump, if I write about the Middle East, if I write about abortion, I don't actually change people's minds. They tend, you know, they've already had positions. But where I think we do have a real impact is our ability to shine our light on an issue that people are not paying attention to, thereby project it onto the agenda, make people spill their coffee in the morning as they read the paper, and, you know, force difficult conversations about subjects that are hard to talk about. And I think this kind of child sexual abuse imagery is one of them. I think a lot of Canadians in particular were unaware that they were host to a company that had that kind of imagery online. And, you know, that Canada was in effect inflicting rape videos on the world. And I think Canadians were embarrassed by that, ashamed of that, and they've been taking action. But, you know, I've got to say that Pornhub is one company among a number, and it becomes really important that one doesn't just stop with Pornhub, because then immediately the business just flows to other rival companies, and you haven't really made a difference. So you've got to, one has to go after the sector and not just one individual company.
Right. You talked about one survivor that reached out to you and said how your article was the spark to getting that removed. What can you talk to the role that survivors played in bringing about these changes?
They were absolutely critical, because, you know, it's those stories that move people. As I said, if you have a debate at 30,000 feet about regulation, about porn, then people have all kinds of different views. When you hear about a 14-year-old girl who has attempted suicide repeatedly because of naked videos that were put on Pornhub that, you know, I mean, destroyed her life is a little bit strong, but, you know, were truly devastating. And as a company made money off her, then I think that anybody's going to feel differently and feel sympathetic and feel that there is an injustice here that needs to be remedied. And so I think it's really important to give a voice to those survivors and explain what, you know, what this means in real life. And they, you know, and I must say it was hard to get survivors to tell these stories, especially with their names attached. And one of the challenges in journalism, as you know, is that if we just write about a, you know, a 14-year-old girl somewhere, then it doesn't have the verisimilitude, it doesn't have the power of being able to give her name and hometown and show her picture and have her talking about it. And it's that reality that moves people, but you also worry about the effect on her. These people have been through so much already and they're humiliated, they're stigmatized, then to ask them to step up and relate all this, to go over the most humiliating period of their lives, is asking a lot of them. And, you know, they were fantastic to cooperate.
Right. Yeah. You talked a little bit about Canada, and that's because Pornhub is headquartered in Canada. Is that why you mentioned Canada?
That's correct.
Yeah. Can you talk to the parenting company of Pornhub, MindGeek, based on the changes that have been made? What do you anticipate will happen with MindGeek in the long run?
So I think that MindGeek is probably going to pay a significant price for the its abuses in the past in terms of civil liability and criminal liability. I don't know, but I think it may well face criminal liability for some of these videos that were on the site. And I think it very likely will as well in lawsuits in Canada and the US. I think that's a real shadow over the company's financial future. My sense of the business model is very hard to get them or anybody to talk about the business model of it, but I think that they actually had a business model that would have been that, you know, if they'd been willing to earn 20% less money, that they could have done it without having that liability, and they in the long run would have been much more, you know, they would have saved themselves a ton of money and saved themselves their jobs and maybe their company. And I think they risked it all by going too far, by not having enough moderators, by letting the moderators approve things that should never have been approved. But you know, that's when companies are on the edge, too often they do that.
All right. In your article, you told the story about a victim who, in the aftermath of her abuse, became homeless. And since your article, because of your article, a GoFundMe was started, and now that person is off the streets and hoping to start vet school. Yeah. Can you talk to that experience a little bit more?
Yeah, her name is Serena Flytus, and she's and you know, it's a tribute to Serena that she was willing to use her name. And you know, that has so much power. It's very evocative. She's 19 now. When she was in the eighth grade, she was a very, very sheltered kid, you know, had never made out with a boy. And then in eighth grade, she has a crush on a ninth grader. He asks her for a naked photo. She's really flattered. She doesn't really know anything about the internet. She sends him a photo. You know, he asks for another, he asks for some videos, she sends them. Then, you know, he shows them to some other kids, they're passed around, then they end up on Pornhub. And her life just collapses. And then boys are telling her that, okay, send me a naked video too, or I'm going to send these to your parents. She is humiliated to go to school. Her mom drops her off at the front school gate. She goes through, walks out the side gate, and just skips school. She transfers to a new school, but there are some kids from the old school who are at the new school, and word immediately goes around, and she ends up dropping out of school. She ends up self-medicating with meth and heroin. She attempts suicide, and you know, this is an A student, and things are going fine, and then she does this really dumb thing. But every 14-year-old kid in human history has done really dumb things. And right. We recover. You have, I have, but those dumb things we did at 14 don't haunt us the way, Serena did something really stupid. And then Pornhub did something to monetize that stupidity in ways that hugely inflamed the situation. And if she had just sent that video to that boy and he'd showed it to some others, yeah, that would have been a real hassle for her. But she would have recovered. And instead, when I talked to her, she was homeless, living in a car with three dogs. And the dogs were the only creatures that were forgiving, that loved her unconditionally. And Serena told her story with, humility. She acknowledged that she'd done really dumb stuff, and she just wanted to warn other kids about how you do something stupid like that, and it, you don't get another chance. And and we sent a photographer to spend a day with her. Photos ran with the story, and I think readers were really moved. They stepped up. We got plenty of readers offering her housing of one kind or another. A couple of different vets offered her jobs in their veterinary offices. People were offering her money to go to, she wanted to go to be a school, to be a vet tech. They were offering her help with that. And one billionaire stepped up and offered her, to pay her tuition. And so that's all unfolding right now. And it's very reassuring, and it's great to see readers step up. It's great to see the impact on Serena, but that is not a scalable model of how to help victims of Pornhub.
Right. Have you had more victims reach out about their experiences with Pornhub since the article?
Yeah, I have. That's wonderful and moving. This one girl who said that when this naked video was taken down of her, that she can breathe again. And, that's great. But then again, I heard of a girl who at 16 had a video put up on the site, and her life went downhill, as it did for Serena, and she attempted suicide, but unlike Serena, she succeeded. And so she is now gone. There's a lot of devastation that has unfolded because of this.
Right. Yeah, that's a very true statement. I'm curious to know a little bit more about the pushback that you've received as a journalist in general, and specifically reporting on this issue.
Sure. Some of the pushback is, I say it comes in two kinds. It's, one element of it is harassment, some death threats, some people, apparently there's a subreddit that has gone after me particularly. And so, so people on that subreddit have been just kind of descending on me. And, you know, but that's, I dish it out. I can take it. I kind of think that if somebody tweets a death threat at you, it's probably not to be taken terribly seriously. And you know, but that's kind of one category. And then the other is, I'd say, a more kind of intellectual kind, which is criticism. Look, I'm socially liberal, and I quoted Exodus Cry and Lila Micklewaite, who's been very, very active on this issue. And so there's a line of critique that, look, you're working with, you know, people who have a homophobic, extreme right wing point of view in ways that actually hugely disadvantage very marginalized sex workers. And then there, you know, so you must be, ultra right wing yourself and so on. And you know, my, you know, I'm sure that I disagree with Lila and with Exodus Cry on all kinds of issues. I don't think there's a basis for saying that they're homophobic, whatever, but I'm sure I disagree profoundly with them. I also think it's really important for liberals and conservatives to actually make common cause on some of these issues. And in the area of human trafficking, we have a Trafficking Victims Protection Act because Bleeding Heart feminists were willing to work with Bleeding Heart evangelicals to pass a major bill at the end of the Clinton administration that right. then the Bush administration implemented aggressively. And, you know, likewise, AIDS is a cause, you know, near and dear to my heart that I reported on an awful lot. And that involved a lot of, again, you know, Bleeding Heart international health activists with Bleeding Heart evangelicals in the Bush administration that has resulted in the PEPFAR program, which has saved 20 million lives so far. And so I'm actually a great believer in trying to bridge some of the faith gaps, some of the left-right gaps, and finding common cause. And if we can find common cause and go after a company that is monetizing the rape of children, then that's, you know, that's great. And I'm, you know, I think I disagree probably with you, probably with a number of other people about in that I'm not intrinsic. I don't really have a view about porn itself, but to me, this is not an issue of being against porn. This is an issue of being against, you know, child rape. And, but again, if we can, we don't have to agree on everything. We can, if we can find a common denominator in agreeing that, you know, imagery of 14-year-old girls shouldn't be on a site, then let's agree on that. Let's go after that. So I see no shame in working with people who, disagree with me. And in fact, I think that's how you get things done. Right. There has been a critique as well that, that some, people, in Model Hub, some adult performers have lost their incomes because of, Visa and MasterCard cutting off payments. I think that that is somewhat overstated because, the credit card companies are still, allowing their cards to be used for ads on their sites. And that is a significant part of the revenue for people on Model Hub. And then there are also plenty of other sites that they can perform on. You know, at the end of the day, you look at trade-offs and it's, you know, it's, I'm sure that when Harvey Weinstein was arrested, people and his business folded, people lost their jobs, and that's too bad. And that's unfortunate, but it was still worth it to have Harvey Weinstein arrested. Likewise, if there are some marginalized folks out there who lose some income on Model Hub. I think that's unfortunate, but I also think of people who no longer have videos themselves as underage kids on Pornhub and who can breathe again. And that's a trade-off I'm willing to make.
Right. Well, what's next for you in regards to this topic specifically? Is it something you've developed a long-term interest in? Will you write another piece, a follow-up piece at some point?
No, we'll see. As I said, I'd written about it to some degree before, and I suspect I will again. I'm interested in X videos in particular, because X videos or the, you know, that holding company, that empire, is arguably even bigger in terms of traffic than the Pornhub/MindGeek empire. And its red lines seem to be even fewer on X videos. I noticed when I was poking around that if you search middle school, then it, among its suggestions, it offered elementary school. You know, I mean, that, you know, how can one of the top 10 websites in the world offer you elementary school kids? I noticed that after I wrote that, they did take out that suggestion. I do think that it's really important that we don't go after just a company, but a sector, or otherwise, you know, then the problems just bounce to some other company. So I may well come back and look at X videos and that empire and, you know, probably tell it in much the same way with stories of victims and the human cost.
Right. Well, Nick, we appreciate your time today. We know your time, you know, you're a busy individual, so we appreciate you joining us today.
Absolutely. And I appreciate, you know, your listeners' interest and activism on an issue that I think is a really important human rights topic, and one that isn't talked enough about. And, you know, for that, I salute you, Garrett, because as a journalist, I've come to conclude that we make the worst policy as a country about issues that are hard to talk about. And that's, you know, it's mental health, it's domestic violence, it's anything to do with sex, it's drugs. And we have to just break those taboos and have conversations, maybe difficult, awkward conversations. And then that lays a basis for an understanding, which lays a basis for better policy. So hats off to you, and keep up the good work.
Yeah, thank you very much. In regards to us tagging you on social media and things, or our audience reaching out to you, are you comfortable with that?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we will make sure to link your social media accounts to this episode, and
sure.
So that our audience can reach out and show you some love and support as well. So
absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. Take care.
Okay. Thanks. Take care.
Looking for a way to spread awareness on the harms of porn? Why not rep the movement in one of our conversation starting tees? With over 20 tees in various designs and phrases, you're bound to find something that speaks to you and will spark conversations with others. Plus, because we're a 501c3 nonprofit, there's no taxes on your purchase, and the proceeds help to mobilize this movement. Get your gear today at ftnd.org/shop. That's ftnd.org/shop.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Consider Before Consuming. Consider Before Consuming is brought to you by Fight the New Drug. Fight the New Drug is a non-religious and non-legislative organization that exists to provide individuals the opportunity to make an informed decision regarding pornography by raising awareness on its harmful effects using only science, facts, and personal accounts. If you want to learn more about today's guest and the conversation we had, you can check out the links included with this episode. Again, big thanks to you for listening to this conversation. As you go about your day, we invite you to increase your self-awareness, look both ways, check your blind spots, and consider before consuming.